Audrey, for people that don't, maybe they're new to the program, new to the station, you're not new to our program. You've been here many times. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Right. So now I'm a defense attorney. I represent juveniles and adults from a range of crimes, from traffic to murder, everything in between, retail thefts, residential burglaries, anything else.
And for years, you spent time in the state's attorney's office, right?
Correct. For approximately 20 years, I was in the prosecutor's office. Correct.
And so you use those skills now to work as a defense attorney.
It does. And I think it does give me advantage. I'm able to see both sides when reviewing police reports or just knowing what arguments to make.
Well, you kind of know what a state's attorney would do it through an investigation, and you can, I don't want to say you know what they do wrong, but you can identify different areas where you might have strength in your case.
Correct. Absolutely. And then I can also see what's missing, what things were left out, or I can see that the case was done perfectly.
You work with a lot of juveniles and adults too. That seems important to you. Why do you like doing that?
It does. I really like working with juveniles. Probably half my practice is dealing with juveniles and representing them for criminal investigations or when they're charged with a crime. I think it's just so important to help step in as juveniles so they don't continue on with crimes, or to try to fix or help them address why they committed the crime to begin with.
So you don't look at it as, well, I'm going to get them off and shake my hand loose of it and see what happens next. You look at finding a solution that works, maybe even for both parties, to see how it can work, or helping give that juvenile defense and then maybe get into the point where they wouldn't do it again.
Right, absolutely. And it's nice dealing with juveniles. They always seem to be very, very grateful for the help and the guidance just because they're so young. Some of them I've represented seventh graders, so that's pretty young, up to 17-year-olds. But they're still young and growing, and so this entire process is somewhat intimidating for them.
I think maybe years ago people would have a little bit more deference or maybe a sweet spot, for lack of a better word, for kids who get into trouble. But nowadays we do see, with the rise in carjackings, you see a lot of juveniles doing things that seem more extreme. I don't know if the data bears that out, that our 14 to 17-year-olds are more violent than they used to be. I have no idea. But does that, I don't want to say make the practice harder, but do you notice some more resistance from people saying, like, why are you defending these people for doing these things?
True, right, because juveniles can commit some pretty horrific crimes that if they were adults, they'd be going to prison for decades. The possession of certain illicit, inappropriate children's pictures or vehicular hijackings, right? So people do wonder, why do this? They should go to prison for a long time. But that's not the case. Sometimes they just need someone there to listen to them. And that's what I try to do.
Okay. Your number is 630-877-5800, AndersonAA.com. We were using you a lot when we were talking about the debate of the Safety Act, the delay of the Safety Act, and then the implementation of the Safety Act. It's withdrawn from the headlines a little bit just simply because time is passing. The first couple of weeks afterwards, everyone was psychoanalyzing every single judge's decision across the state. Here we are 6 months later. Generally speaking, what are you hearing from people?
I think people are pleasantly surprised that it's actually gone so smoothly. But I think that's because so many state attorney's office, public defender's offices, probation departments, the jails, they really had time to gear up and try to perfect the process. They knew it was coming, so they were trying to get it streamlined as best as possible.
When you say smoothly, you mean like the actual courtroom proceedings, how lawyers would identify, how it works, the different processes. That has gone fairly smooth.
Correct. Such as like the logistics of it, the paperwork, the process. How does each public defender who's assigned to the pretrial unit, how do they get the opportunity to deal with speaking to each client that comes before court that morning? How does probation deal with drafting these reports, these risk assessments that they're required to now present to the judge? How does that logistically work? And then judges, how do they take the time to process and read everything and go from one defendant to the next defendant?
Because there is a lot more individual case by case you take it by right now, right?
Correct.
Why is that? What can you explain that change again?
Sure. So now it's either you're detained in custody or you're released. There's no argument over bond. So then it does definitely take a longer. These pretrial or first appearance courts that used to be bond court, they do take longer because it takes a while for the prosecutors to get the police reports, which they're supposed to tender to defense attorneys. And honestly, public defenders, they're the ones that handle most of these. So they read all the police reports, then the prosecutor decides whether or not to detain or not to detain. And then if they're going to be released, what conditions to agree upon, like an electronic bracelet or GPS or no entry or drug drops, things like that.
So by making it a binary choice for judges saying release or don't release, it became a more complicated case, and it required more research and argument to make the case, as opposed to when they had a range of possibilities. Am I understanding? Am I summing that up okay?
Somewhat, yes. Right, exactly. Because before, everyone knew that they would stay in custody until a bond was posted or a recognizance. But now there's just more things that defense attorneys need to review before they proceed to the first appearance or what used to be bond court, and more assessments that need to be presented at these hearings. Whereas before, under the old way of bond court, it was just the prosecutor giving a summary of the facts and criminal history and defense attorney speaking with their clients if they had time for a few minutes. And then the law changed. You had to speak with the client. Now with release or detain, there has to be in person. Defense attorneys have to speak with the inmates. There has to be this risk assessment. Defense attorneys have to read police reports. They didn't have all those conditions before the initial bond court proceeding, before the Pretrial Fairness Act came into effect.
So the process, how it works with the judges, with the lawyers, that has gone more smoothly than people maybe thought. But maybe they're crediting the delay that the Supreme Court, they held for months. It was supposed to go into effect, I believe, at the start of the year. Then there was a delay, or maybe it was March of last year. These details are now, I'm losing them from last year. There was a delay. And are they crediting that delay to making things smoother in the long run?
Somewhat, yes. I know bigger, more affluent counties, Cook, DuPage, the Collar ones, they were obviously prepared because it was supposed to come into effect and then was delayed. But it did give them time to practice longer, especially the smaller counties. They didn't have as many resources and gave them definitely more time.
Okay. What about the implementation and the results in terms of things that people feared, that the jail doors would be open on the day that it went into effect, or that you'd have so many people that wouldn't be allowed to go out because there was no cash bail, and they would then go on crime sprees or commit crimes? What have we seen in that department?
Well, from what I've seen, and I've been asking many other private defense attorneys, public defenders, prosecutors, probation even, or inmates, like clients, or even police officers, law enforcement, if they've actually seen that, people really haven't seen the floodgates open and everyone being released. Because the arguments for a person having a high bail to begin with, those can be the same arguments for a prosecutor that now with the no bail situation you're either out or in, those can still be in effect. The reason a person had initially a high bond of $1 million or $100,000 was because of a risk to the public or a risk to a person or a willful flight. So those are the same types of arguments. So it's not as if once the law became effect in, I think, September of last year, that changed, that the person was no longer a risk to a specific individual or no longer a flight risk.
So in essence, actually, and we had kind of talked about this last year too, that someone that may have been given $100,000, $500,000 or $1 million bond, those people, for the most part now, do not get to go out. They were deemed to, whereas before they still would have had an opportunity to post bond, now they don't. So some of the higher bond crimes, people that were accused of more violent crimes, instead of if they did have the with for all or the finances to get out of it, they don't now. They are staying in prison, and that may be contributing to them obviously not being out on the streets, being able to do it again.
Exactly. So that's some of the discussions that defense attorneys have with their clients who were in custody beforehand on, say, a $500,000 bond. Our clients, inmates are now hearing, well, I can get out now. Well, no, if you now say you want to get out, the prosecutors file a motion to have you detained. So now if you're detained, you're right, it's a no bond. So as before, if you somehow came up with $50,000 actual to get out, you could. Now if the judge grants the prosecutor's request, denies a request to have you be released, now you're in there for no bond, so you can't get out.
Right, and the people that are quote-unquote getting out are the people, and again, these are people that have not been found convicted of a crime. This is when they've just been charged. The people that are being released before their trials are likely the people that would have been, if there still was bail in place, given lower bail amounts because of less serious accusations, right?
Correct. That's from what we've been seeing.
So not to say that there aren't some incidents, right? I mean, I'm sure that people will pull out cases of someone that was released, although we do not, and that's what makes this difficult. Let's say someone is released with no cash bail and they do commit a crime, and someone goes, see, they would have been in prison or they would have been in jail if there was still bail. Not necessarily, right?
Right, not necessarily, because what if their bail was set at $100,000? What if a bunch of friends got together to post their money? They could have posted the bond and gotten out. So they still committed a new crime, but I suppose they had bond money that could then eventually get used to pay for programs and court costs and things like that.
There were a lot of other nuances in the Safety Act that I know were touched on and rewritten. A lot of officers came on this program, or sheriffs, worrying about how they would be able to. There was the example of, like, well, if someone is trespassing in a shed, we're not going to have the ability to arrest them on site. There's certain things we cannot arrest, certain misdemeanors that we can't arrest for, detain for. Have you heard any rumblings about police officers about not being able to do the jobs, or do you not have enough research on that?
No, I have, because from my prosecutor days, there's a lot of officers that I still talk with.
Uh-huh.
And just talk generally to them about the facts. They don't obviously tell me about a specific individual or names, and I don't do the same also. But you're right. With trespass, they could only just do a summons or a warning that you couldn't arrest them. However, there's still the loophole that if you find that they're a threat to themselves or others, you could still arrest them and take them to be detained in custody.
And when you say loophole, you mean, or a legitimate, I mean.
Correct. It's a legitimate exception.
Yeah, you didn't mean
correct.
It as like
I didn't mean it like as a.
Oh, we're going to arrest you because, oh, we're making it up. You just correct. Mean that that's an exception.
Right. It's an exception. It's an option for those that are maybe trespassing because they have mental health or they're a serious threat to someone, as opposed to just some kid that wandered into the park after hours, or some young adult or even an older person that does something dumb, but not with malice or threat to a specific individual or person, but someone that has significant mental health or they actually do intend to harm someone, they still could be detained by the law.
Right. So from police officer perspective, you haven't heard many gigantic gripes about how they're able to do their job still.
Well, it's still difficult because it's so much more legalese. So the officers, as opposed to it was more fair, clean cut, or easier to decipher for police officers. You know, you see a person committing a crime, you arrest him, you bring him back to the police department. Now they have to go through these series of what ifs and flow charts to figure out, can they be detained? They all have to know the law so much better. And they did obviously know the law back then, but I think it's a lot more complicated for officers, patrol officers, sergeants, and everyone who's supervising them.
Okay, so maybe it is making their jobs more difficult, which could have ripple effects in other ways. But so far, no major incidents have arisen from it. Is that a fair way to say it?
Mm-hmm. Not that I've heard.
Right.
And I know officers, they were prepared, and prosecutors got out there and they were training police departments all the time. And there's obviously a good relationship, hopefully, between law enforcement and their prosecutors, so they can reach out to a prosecutor with questions.
Right. And we are painting with a broad brush here. We don't mean to. This is who you've chatted with and the research you've done. I'm sure people will call in, or officers might, and they're more than welcome to, who have encountered different situations. But just based on your understanding, 6 months into this, I'm not asking you to call it a success or a failure, but I guess the big worries that people had have not really borne fruit yet.
I don't think it's as bad as people predicted it to be, because now they know this is what it is. So people have adjusted. So all the worries of the unknown has been removed.
Right.
So I don't think it's as bad. They've just come to accept that this is the new process for the law in Illinois.
Not that that couldn't change. There could be situations that happen down the line where we look back and say that wasn't the right thing to do. But that's your view from 6 months out.
True. Correct.
Okay. Got a couple minutes before the news, and we'll keep Audrey Anderson after the news as well. But Audrey, we talked about the Safety Act and some good texts coming in, 312-981-7200. We can read some of those responses after the news and weigh those. But I did want to get to the case of Jennifer Crumbly, who was the mother of a school shooter in Michigan, found guilty of manslaughter. This is a very unique case, isn't it?
Right. I believe those two parents, the mom and dad, I think were the first ever that were charged, and I'm pretty positive she's the first ever that's been convicted of it.
Yes. Parents have been charged for things that their kids have done, but true. Not in a mass school shooting.
Correct.
Or a case like this.
Correct. Not in this type, to hold the parents responsible for what their child did in a mass school shooting. Correct.
What was the reasoning behind this? Why haven't we seen this in other cases? Was this one different in how the shooting played out, I guess you could say?
I think the facts were different in this one compared to other ones, and that the specific day of the shooting, from my understanding of reading everything, the school had concerns because the high school student, had drawn pictures of wanting to shoot people and kill people. So the school actually brought in mom and dad, said their concerns, and the parents said, oh, it's no big deal, but we're not taking him home, and then left shortly thereafter. He went to his backpack, which was never searched, apparently. There was a gun, and then he shot up. Unfortunately, the students in the school.
Yeah, there seemed to be, maybe a link's not the right word, but there seemed to be an abundance of evidence that the parents, the mother specifically, I guess, should have known something was awry or done something a little bit different to try and prevent it. That's what makes this one a little different, right?
Correct. So even though the acts that the parents did, I think the dad bought the gun, the mom took the son shooting at a range. I mean, those can legitimately be argued as, that's great, you're teaching your child how to use weapons safely.
Right.
But they should have realized with his mental health and the issues that he had stemming from violence that they should have been made aware.
Okay. Let's pick that up on the other end, and any questions that the listeners have, 312-981-7200 is our phone number. 630-877-5800 is Audrey Anderson's phone number, AndersonAA.com. A couple minutes left with Audrey Anderson from Anderson Attorneys and Advisors. We were talking about the Safety Act. You also defend a lot of juveniles in cases that they have to deal with. And we were also talking about the mother of the Michigan school shooter who was found guilty of charges against her, manslaughter charges, for, I guess, not knowing or trying to prevent the crime that happened. We have a couple texts related to those topics. Let's get to those. Let's start with the Michigan case. 708 chimed in with a really good point. My question is, and just to rewind in case someone's joining us, the school brought in the mom and dad, right, Audrey? That day,
the school brought in, as soon as they saw it, the teacher, whomever, brought it to the school's attention.
The drawings
that the student he had made. Mm-hmm. They brought in the parents. The parents did go. They voluntarily went. They heard the school and said they didn't think that there was an issue and said, we're not taking your son, and left.
And that's one of the reasons she's been charged with manslaughter. Or that was some of the evidence that led to the guilty charge. So the 708 wants to know is, if the school felt the child should have gone home, why did they let him return to the school population instead of keeping him segregated from the rest of the student? It's not unusual for students to have to sit in the office for the day or the social worker's office. Your thoughts, Audrey?
That's very true. And I've seen that done, where schools can't get in touch with the parents because, for who knows what reason, the parents busy, they can't answer the phone, they're working, whatever. So they do have a child just sitting there on a bench or in an office. But there could be a variety of reasons, perhaps, that the school didn't. Maybe they didn't have anyone to watch the student, or you can't physically tie down and restrain a student. So maybe they did have him sitting in a chair or whatever, and he just got up and walked out. That could be the case too. So I don't know why he wasn't, you can't lock him in his own room.
Can a school force the parents to take them home? Could they have said, well, I know you don't want to bring him home, but you need to?
No, unfortunately, a school cannot do that. So, and the parents have the right to refuse. I mean, they could eventually.
That sounds crazy. Wait. A school says, I don't think this kid should be here today. Something is up and he needs to go home. Take him home. And the parents say no. The school then can't say, no, you're taking him home.
Correct. The school can't force a parent to take a child home. So the school's only options are, like the texter said, put the person in a room and hope they stay there, because you can't force the student to stay. The second one is to call a police officer, law enforcement, and say, look, we think this kid's a threat. I don't know technically what the crime is. Maybe disorderly conduct, because the teacher who saw the drawing was alarmed and disturbed. Or three, contact DCFS and wait for eventually DCFS to show up. They don't show up within minutes. It could be hours for them to take protective custody of the student or try to figure out where to place the student. So the options for the school could be fairly limited.
So his mom found guilty of manslaughter, but and I'm sure school officials are talking about and have talked about what they did or didn't do, and schools around the country are probably analyzing this case, hopefully for learning something from it, because just because she was found guilty of manslaughter doesn't mean that there wasn't things that the school could have done better.
That's true. And I know a lot of schools are looking at their own policies. A lot of schools sent out emails to parents and guardians for students saying, look, this is the steps that we have. This is our process. A lot of schools are hiring independent businesses to analyze their process for dealing with students like this, or just threats. So I know a lot of schools are looking into it and trying to figure out what to do better.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a parent yet. I hope to be soon. But if a school calls me in and says, well, you need to take your kid home, I think I would do it. But I guess I could envision a situation where you're like, no, I don't think so. Okay. 773, going to the juvenile side of things. And we were talking about the Safety Act, which everyone knows now, 6 months into it, someone can, you either are held before your trial or not. That's actually always how it's been for juveniles, right, Audrey?
Right. Juveniles never had a post bond because, I guess typically juveniles, their job is going to school, and maybe they have a part-time job. Mm-hmm. So it's always been, they've either been detained at a youth home or out.
Right. Someone texted in from the 773 that they work in this system, that juveniles are never detained beyond 2 days. Crimes with a weapon require that juveniles go to Hamilton. What is Hamilton, by the way?
So Hamilton is in Cook County. There's different divisions of courthouses. So Hamilton is one where a lot of juvenile cases are heard.
Crimes with weapons require juveniles to go there, to Hamilton, for 1 day. But robbery, carjacking, almost 100% result in the kids going home. So I guess this is a situation, Audrey, where certain counties do things one ways and others don't.
Correct. And obviously, I don't know the specific facts of that person that texted in. So they could be seeing that, or there could be mitigating circumstances. Maybe it's a child that's very young, maybe only a 13-year-old. So should they be detained because they have no history? Or maybe that student had only a minor involvement or no criminal background, or there's treatment options for that student, so that's why they're released. It's not a policy that you can only hold a student for up, or a child for only 2 days. So I think it just depends on the facts of each of the cases.
All right. So you do a lot of work in DuPage County. What are you seeing? Are juveniles held longer than 2 days sometimes for violent crimes?
It just depends. I don't just do DuPage. I don't do, I do a lot of the collar counties with detained juveniles. Mm-hmm. But I think not necessarily are they being held, because the goal of juvenile detention in juvenile court is rehabilitation. So I believe that even in arguing from my cases in all the counties, not just DuPage, and same with other juvenile defense attorneys, they are seeing some kids that have more severe backgrounds or severe facts are being held for slightly longer. But a lot of times there are more services that could possibly be offered to a student and their family. If the kid is released to their parents, they can be on home detention, meaning they're on lockdown. They can't leave the house except for school, classes, counseling, or there's other counseling services that probation and pretrial could offer for that student compared to if they were detained in juvenile youth home.
This is like a head and a heart thing. Like, I agree that if you're 13 or 14, our goal, and really for adults too, should be rehabilitation, of course. But like, especially with kids, you want to like stop that kid from their life that they've entered of crime and turn them around. But I also completely understand the other side of things when people's cars are being stolen at gunpoint and these kids go on a joyride and crash into someone else. I mean, they really are a danger to people in society in many ways. And if I was the victim of that, or I knew someone that was, I would want those kids to still be behind jails so that they couldn't do it again. This is hard stuff.
Right. It's very hard because, right, as the victim of a crime, or if you're the friend of a victim of a crime, you completely understand why you want some kid locked up until the case is heard and then go to juvenile prison. But then on the flip side, for those that are in social work or other professions, they can see, well, the child just needs help. This is a cry for help, or there's some reason beyond why a kid did what he or she did. So to have them get out, go to probation, go to pretrial services that are offered, compared to just locking them up at a youth home where they get group therapy sometimes and go to some form of school.
Yeah, I think maybe a lot of us would have more faith in that idea if we felt like there was a lot of help that happens and kids do turn around. And I guess that's where I'll ask you, and maybe this is a good place to kind of wrap it up, Audrey. I think we all have a vision in our head of when someone is a carjacker at 13, they're going to be a criminal the rest of their life, and there's nothing we can do about that. Are there plenty of success stories, few success stories, a lot of success stories of kids turning their lives around after doing something really dumb and potentially violent?
Right. We've seen it. I think that there are success stories. It just depends on each kid. I mean, the people that work in the youth home, they do everything they can to provide services, but they have limited resources. So allowing a kid maybe perhaps to be out for probation to offer more services, that could be an option. I think the argument is at least giving the kid an opportunity to help fix something to better their life, as opposed to just locking them up and throwing away the key. But other arguments are maybe they do just need to be locked up and the key thrown away until they're 21, and then good luck to them afterwards.
Yeah, this is so tough. I mean, it's always about more resources and more money, legitimately so, going to places. I think in an ideal society, we would design it that way, that if a kid commits a crime, you know, the solution that ultimately leads to them not committing crimes as adults is the best way to go. But each kid is an individual. We have no idea what they're going to do moving forward. So we weigh these. Should a 13-year-old sit in a detention center until they're trying? I mean, we just weigh these things. And often, Audrey, there's no perfect answer, is there?
Right. You're definitely correct. There's no perfect answer, unfortunately, and so many differing opinions.
I thought we were going to solve it today, Audrey. We
tried. Maybe next time.
Maybe next time. Next time you're on, for sure. All right, Audrey, you do a lot of great work. Who should be calling you?
anyone, parents, that they have issues themselves or their kids are being investigated by police or have been charged with a crime.
Okay, 630-877-5800, AndersonAA.com. Take care, Audra. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thank you.